And welcome to another edition of Tea with Nettie, the first of 2024. And my guest today is our principal viola, Max Mandel, who is a rumbustious personality with very strong views and feelings, extremely entertaining. I realised when I was listening through to this that I did far more talking than I should have, and even than I usually do, but somehow it ended up being such a stimulating conversation. I hope you will learn as much as I did.
Tea with Nettie.
Here we are, post-prandially, very cordially.
Very nice.
And it's quite funny for me to be actually face-to-face with you because I'm usually sitting either behind you or occasionally next to you. But actually to have the full frontal Max is quite sort of overwhelming.
Yikes, yikes. Yeah, I'm aware that, you know, you're one of the people who taught me and Martin Kelly as well about being aware of what you look like from behind.
Really, you mean important. You know.
It's really important to imagine what you look like from behind when at the front of a section.
You're very explicit. The choreography is actually very helpful.
It's one of those things that orchestral playing, well, it's important to remember what it's like in every part of the section, I think, for anybody, wherever you're sitting. If you're sitting at the back, you need to have sympathy for the person at the front. If you're at the front, you have sympathy for the person at the back. And I think that you can get very involved, particularly in our worlds, to try to make it like an extension of chamber music. And then sometimes the viola gets low and you start feeling it and you're making eye contact with the principal second or whatever. And then actually there's maybe five or six people who have to have an understanding of what you're doing. Yeah. When I first joined the orchestra, you know, because my life is quite varied, when you re-enter orchestra, you have to switch on that orchestra brain. And
yes.
Martin Kelly was very good. Our colleague Martin was very good at saying, get that viola in the air.
Oh, really?
Hold that viola up so that we can all see you, you know.
Well, it's true that some of us are a little bit vertically, if not horizontally, challenged.
Right.
It is helpful.
Yeah. This is the trees, Nettie amongst the trees.
Yes, I do feel as if I'm amongst the trees. But as well as that, it can be compounded if a conductor only talks to the first desks. I mean, the most effective conductors are the ones where the people at the back feel included as well and empowered.
Yes, they need to remember that. It can get a bit like a club.
Yes.
You know, like when there's that feeling that they're up front talking with their chums and then the last row of the wind just completely tune out.
Yes.
You just think, you go, you're losing them, you're losing them. They want to know what's happening.
And particularly if you've got brass players having a little conversation of their own because they're tacit, they're not actually playing.
Right.
It can be quite difficult. Actually, I don't know why I singled out brass players. It could be anybody, couldn't
it? No,
do.
Clarinets are equally
yes.
guilty.
Anyway, well, here you are, and we're very lucky to have you in OAE, and if I can't remember, it's well, I do remember, of course, very well before you arrived, but somehow you seem to have been part of the fabric of OAE for so long, and you were on the Players Artistic Committee as well, which really embedded you in there very quickly because you were passionate about wanting to be really involved, weren't
yes.
you? And how did that feel coming into it, having not even been living in this country anyway?
I mean, yeah.
Total immersion from zero.
Well, I think that one of the reasons why the group appealed to me is because of its structure of being an orchestra-run group with a committee, like a representative democracy. I like that idea that the group votes and then we have a representative group of five people who work with the chief exec to figure everything out. That system seemed very appealing to me from afar.
Yes.
Besides, the reputation of the orchestra was incredible and I listened to your recordings and it's the ultimate... we strive to be, you know, this historically informed whatever music we're doing, which is another thing because I do all kinds of music. That's my preference, is to do everything. So I thought, oh gosh, this is the best possible job for me. I've always avoided having a job. I'd never had a proper job, never joined an orchestra before the OE. So that appealed to me. So then upon arriving, someone said, you'd be good. You were probably the one who said, you'd be good for the committee, which is flattering, of course. And you think, oh, should I stand? I don't know the group that well. Should I go for a while? I do want to be involved. And then you realize that it's a bit like, well, let's get the new guy to do it because he's a sucker. He doesn't know what he's in for. You know. So then you go, oh, geez, it's a lot of work and an enormous amount of responsibility, because I would say that when I first came on the committee, joined the orchestra, I'd only been in for a year, and to sit with colleagues at the time, I remember being particularly in awe of Lisa Bisnuziak, because she was the flute sound that I knew of, yes, the Baroque flute, so I was a fan of hers. And then I'm sitting there on this committee with her and with all her experience. And then someone like Cecilia Brueggemeyer was the chair at the time, and she's so incredibly organized. And Roger Montgomery is just a class individual. And the depth of knowledge of all these people, and you think, well, I've got my opinions, but they're just my opinions. So I should keep them to myself until I sort of understand how it works. And I knew to keep my mouth shut for the first year, uncharacteristically.
Did you?
Yes. So for the first year, I said to myself, well, the first year on the committee, you're just going to sit back and listen. You can make comments where they're useful, but you're just going to defer.
Was that a struggle? Yeah. I mean, did you have to keep reminding yourself of
that? Yes, Nettie, yes, I did have to keep reminding myself. The best orchestras, I think, are the ones that are able to pass on their historical knowledge of the group and how it works and how it exists, so that you can keep what we've gained and what we've learned and how it started, and that new people can come in and soak it up and keep it rolling forward and bring their own new perspective. But just that I am very aware of what came before. Yes. I think there's a lot of chamber orchestras in the world that started in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. And we're all facing new challenges now. So it's interesting to see all these different groups shifting at this time.
But I would say that OAE actually has had to adapt. The financial climate is so much chillier now than it was when we started. We were so lucky. We didn't realize exactly how lucky we were. But we have had to mold ourselves to circumstances. The most obvious thing being implanting ourselves in a school. I mean, that is the most dramatic change we've had,
right,
and the implications it brings with it.
Yeah, I envy your generation. I mean, I remember starting doing recordings just when I started turning professional, mid-90s, and then it all started to dry up. And then going, I just missed it. I'm just feeling that a golden age. I'd just come in at the tail end, just starting out. But can't imagine what it's going to be like in the future.
Well, no, exactly. And you call it the tail end, but you will be the link to the future generations, won't you?
Yeah,
long after we've gone, the oldies. I mean, the dinosaurs are just beginning to become extinct.
People are going to say, oh, you knew it.
Yeah, exactly. But it is true. OAE in particular is a pretty rich mosaic of all the different groups. Doing all the recording at that time. As groups went, OAE did far fewer recordings than all the other groups, because recording companies found it very underwhelming that they couldn't pin one name to us, that we were an orchestra without a recognised leader like Gardiner or Pinnock or Hogwood. And therefore, a lot of our recordings, we were backing groups, but, you know, singers like Lorraine Hunt Lieberson would choose us to be their backing group for a recording. And we did a couple of things with Sir Charles McCarris and with Simon Rattle and with Mark Elder as well for Opera Aurora. But we didn't really do very much for ourselves, things we really wanted to do.
Yeah.
Because it was quite difficult.
Well, we still face that challenge, don't we? Getting into places.
It's true.
We need, people want a name. And it's frustrating to me because I think the identity of our orchestra is very strong. Our mission is very strong.
Yes.
And the collaborative relationships that we form are very powerful, artistically satisfying and rewarding for them and for us.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult to sell tickets, but I feel that presenters, where is that trust that says,
exactly,
we deliver? I feel like we deliver. I mean, I don't want to boast, but I do feel that we are quite consistent in delivering something of good quality and something interesting and challenging with all kinds of different people that we collaborate with. So you would like it if someone said, well, if the OAE says this conductor is worth having, then we trust the OAE. I don't know how one breaks through.
Do you think it's something to do with the fact that our repertoire list is so wide, and they like to go and hear people doing lots of Handel and Bach, and anything after Mozart is a bit scary, or maybe they prefer just to hear Beethoven onwards. But we do the entire range, don't we, from Monteverdi and Strozzi all the way up to, I mean, we're talking of Stravinsky, whether that will happen or not remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think it's easy. It's easier. I'm just going to say it. They play it safe, the presenters and the agents. They want a sure thing. And it's very easy to say Christopher Hogwood does X, whatever. It's easy for them to just say, this is his thing. Mm-hmm. This is what you're getting. Mm-hmm. We can sell it on that. Whether it's good or bad or not, they're risk averse. Yes. So to me, it's like if you say, well, they're a historical performance group, but they're playing Mahler. Mm. You know, people go, is that going to be any good? What's that going to sound like? You know, whereas it's a challenge of the economic climate, as you say, but it's also a failure of these presenters not trusting their audience and not saying, actually, you heard this group play Handel with Lieberson. Mm. Now they're coming to do Brahms. Mm. They're going to understand that we're going to apply our commitment and our rigor that we did with Handel for that audience. Mm. We're coming back with Brahms, and won't that be fascinating? Mm. And I wish somehow someone was making that pitch, because all we can do is do our best and turn
up. But then, talking of Brahms, you know, we did do Brahms with Sandra Schiff, and everyone loved it. The critics loved it. And that got recorded, and the recording got rave reviews as well. So we should be trusted
for Brahms.
Exactly,
but it always feels like this sort of this mountain that you have to climb every time. And I did hear Steve Martin saying that it's always an audition. Every time, if you're on The Tonight Show or if you're at dinner, it's always an audition. I feel that it's terrible and wonderful that you can't sort of sit back and coast. You know, it would be nice to just sort of say, we're the OE and you should have us. On the other hand, being forced to be at the top of our game every single time because people don't trust us, maybe it makes our concerts that much more exciting.
Maybe it does. And of course, we try to make a point of giving our directors rehearsal time, but compared to what happens on the continent, I mean, it's nothing like, is it?
Yeah.
But it also means that everyone is far more on the ball. You just have to be, don't you?
Yeah.
And then, of course, we're very lucky that we have our 3 months at Glyndebourne in the summer where we're associated with them and in the employ of that. Well, we do manage to get a few of our own concerts in between as where we come out of the pit. But
Well, Glyndebourne is the time, it is a time where we bond, don't we? Because there's
because
all that
down. Because it's the same personnel the whole
same
summer.
Personnel. Yeah. And it's that beautiful place, and you sit on the lawn, and you know, there's always time for a tea or a coffee or a viola picnic.
Yeah.
That's the highlight. Well, I mean, to tell a story about Glyndebourne, the first time I came, I was invited, and I was driven down from South London by Matthew Truscott, and we arrived, and we got to Glyndebourne, and Matthew said, "So where are you going to change?" Because I was going to the show. I said, "What do you mean change?" And he said, "Oh, I suppose no one told you." So I had no idea what it was about.
Oh.
I just thought it was going to be some like Tanglewood or just sitting I heard picnic.
Course.
And I thought, we had a viola picnic planned.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, it's going to be just outdoors. How fancy can it be? I thought I looked quite nice, actually. But Matthew was like, no. So he took me to wardrobe, to the costume department. And they got me a tuxedo. I got fitted for a tuxedo before.
Brilliant.
And I remember I came out and you said, the old viola said, "Oh, Max, don't you look nice?" I said, "Well, it's not my tuxedo."
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
Yes, you did. Actually, I do remember you looking very nice, but I forgot the wardrobe story. Well, that was very quick-witted of Matthew, wasn't it?
Typical.
He's one of the most creative people we have, isn't he? Talk of thinking outside the box, or outside the wardrobe, I should say.
Right, exactly, yeah. Yeah, and I remember Nick Logie's homemade gelato, which was that was remarkable. I
mean,
I don't think I've ever tasted anything that good.
Mm. Yes, that was memorable, wasn't it? Yes. Well, anyway, as we sort of come to a natural pause while we're thinking about that wonderful ice cream, we need to remind people, you come from Toronto, don't you? And you played the violin, didn't you, first?
Yes.
And I believe you came to the viola surprisingly late from the violin. What took you so long?
I know. Come on. Get on with it. Well, yeah. I started on the violin at the age of 6. And I was given a choice between violin and piano. You're playing one of these. Choose. Okay. Played violin. And that went on for a long time. And then I was in the Toronto Symphony Youth Orchestra, and there was a chamber music components. And my friend Daniel Bard, who's a wonderful violinist who lives in Europe now also, we wanted to have a group together. And his brother Shalom was a wonderful clarinet player, and we wanted to play the Brahms clarinet quintet. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'll have a go at the viola, because I'd tried it and kind of liked it. And so I remember I prepared for the first rehearsal. I prepared the first movement rigorously.
Yes.
And everyone turned to me and said, wow, Max, you're doing so great. Sounds great. Do you want to read the second movement? I was like, no, because I'd put a fingering over every single note just to be able to manage. So then we decided that we wanted to start a string quartet. And again, it was like, well, we'll probably find another violinist easier than finding another viola player. And I was kind of getting into it a little bit. Mm-hmm. So we started the string quartet together. He had found a cellist, and her name is Rachel Mercer. Part of this, it's called the Glenn Gould School now in Toronto at the conservatory there, but it was called something else at the time, the Young Artists Performance Academy or something. And we just submitted that we wanted to have a quartet, but we had three people. And so the man who ran the program dropped in this violinist who had just appeared from the west coast of Canada, and her name is Aislinn Noske. And Aislinn is now a renowned Baroque violinist and leader of Handel and Haydn Society in Boston, and has come to the OE. I mean, this is before I had any whiff of performance practice. So we were so lucky to have Aislinn just dropped in there. And we had this very, very intense string quartet for 6 years. That was a very deeply bonding situation and really formed everything, just a very formative experience for me in a lot of ways. But we went in the summers to the Banff Center for the Arts outside of Calgary in Banff, Alberta. Great program there where many great musicians taught in the summertime. And we were meant to go for 3 weeks for a quartet program. And there was another 3 weeks that was master classes after that. And I had left my violin at home because I thought I was only going for 3 weeks. Yes. But I ended up staying for 6 weeks.
Oh, wow.
With only viola. And I worked with Karen Tuttle, the teacher there. Yeah. And at the end of 6 weeks, it suddenly dawned on me that it was not just a lower, bigger violin. Something happened of just not being able to go back to violin, back and forth from violin to viola, just being forced to have viola, only viola for 6 weeks. And actually to be in a class with remarkable violists from Europe and America who had come to Canada to study with Karen, that opened my eyes. Mm. And so I remember that summer going, oh, okay, there's more to this than I thought.
Mm.
It actually goes a bit deeper. So I came back to university. This was midway through my undergraduate degree. And I started taking lessons with the principal viola of the orchestra, Stephen Dan, who became my mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a whole other world from the pedagogy that I had had before. Because I'd studied with these violinists, these kind of nasty, domineering, overbearing, aggressive people, emotionally manipulative, screaming at you, telling you that
get
you're terrible.
Off the fence, Mike.
Just this experience of just feeling ground down, or maybe they saw something in me that they thought I needed breaking or whatever, but it was always a battle, and I always felt quite small.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember my first lesson with Steve. I was played a Brahms sonata for him, and he said, so he was about to tell me something, and then he stopped himself. He said, well, let me ask you, why are you doing that? And I kind of looked around, and I thought, well, no one has ever asked me why. Everyone's just said, do it this way.
Mm.
I thought, is this always what viola is like? Is this the viola world where you're allowed to have an opinion? So it was very appealing. And so I started working with him and let go of the violin. And I just thought, I don't need this. I'm so much happier over here in this world with these people.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. And you never look back. And
No. I mean, I'll play violin as a party trick, you know, if you get enough glasses of wine in
no,
me.
No, thank you. It's all right.
Not now. But, you know, it will happen. If there's like a Haydn quartet, you know, late night reading, and I don't mind.
That,
I don't mind picking up the violin.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what led you to join Tafel Music? What was that?
Well, so I was never a member of Tafel Music because they only have two violas in their core. But there was a point where I became the regular. When they expanded, I was first call for all their classical repertoire when they ride with four. But there's a number of things going on, which was Toronto in the 90s. It was sort of pretty normal to think of doing gut strings. It wasn't it didn't feel weird. It felt like all my friends were kind of experimenting with it. I had some friends who had started their own ensemble and just said, we need a viola player to come along. Like, oh, you do it. Oh, okay, what, 4:15? What? Okay, yes. Just do it, just do it. So just started doing it without any kind of knowledge of anything. And it dovetailed with playing string quartets because I felt the training that we had received was figure it out for yourselves or just keep practicing until you play in tune. And through, she turned out to be my partner for a long time, Julia Wedman. She was doing historical performance practice. And I remember she had formed a quartet at Banff, and they had been together for a few weeks, and they played perfectly in tune. And my group, which had been together for several years, struggled to play in tune desperately. And then she just sort of said to us, well, you know, like low major thirds, and there is such a thing as a perfect third. And I was like, what? So that world, when they connect, I started going, they know something. There's information here that hasn't been available to me at this point.
Yes.
And so I got really switched on to that world. And then, you know, almost after you've been through your undergrad and master's, then I started thinking, then I started learning, started educating myself. So then you start reading, and then you start knowing, and then it just kind of goes, well, if this is the way it was done, why wouldn't you try to do it this way? Just as a starting point, the instruments and that kind of thing. So, yeah, so I started doing that, and then grateful that Jean Lemon accepted me as a regular and put her trust in me, and started doing a lot of playing with them. And so that became a regular part of my life, doing it. And so that's on the same track as wanting to be a chamber musician and living in New York and doing contemporary music. And it all sort of starts to make sense in a way of, a general way of approaching music, that things start to coalesce. So I don't really separate this stuff. I think there's an approach of historical performance practice that always suited me. I just didn't discover it until a bit later.
Yeah.
You know, so once it arrived, then I was like, oh, this makes sense. It felt like it was always there inside of me.
I agree with you. I've always felt it's a very artificial thing when someone said, oh, well, would you like us to do this Mozart in a modern way or earlier, and there shouldn't be any divide, should there? Because the Baroque flowed into the classical, which flowed into the Romantic, and it has to be related to what was happening before, in a way, like what you were saying about orchestras, really. There has to be some continuity, although that can be hijacked by teachers that say, oh, well, my teacher learnt with someone who learnt with Clara Schumann, and therefore this, and of course everything gets slightly distorted depending upon the times in which you are performing and the audiences to whom you're performing and the spaces in which you're performing. So things do get pulled out of shape. And if you're lucky, you don't lose your original horizon.
Well, I think it's about language. And what is the language of the composer? And how can we understand that, what they're after? And part of that is understanding, you know, the era that they were in and where they came from. So if you've become completely absorbed in one language, then you can lose the other language. If I become stuck in with Bartok and Hindemith and Webern, if I live that for decades, then the way I speak Mozart may have changed. So in a sense, you need to go back and relearn. So I think it's about sort of starting fresh again, as you're saying. Like, you go back and you look at it. Try to look at it with clean eyes. Try to delete what you know and start again. And that was the thing that Jean really instilled in me and all my colleagues in Tafel Music, which was, I was lucky enough to work with them when they were doing Beethoven for the first time.
Yes.
And so to me, that they're going, yes, it's felt so revolutionary and wild and avant-garde, because they had really only ever played, they play a little bit of Mozart here and there, but they're a Baroque orchestra, and they're sitting there going, Beethoven 6, what does that sound like, you know? And you had this feeling that it was really avant-garde new music. And so then you actually have a closer understanding of what the audiences must have felt like at the time, with their hair being blown back, that this is wild stuff, you know?
And you also, along with the feeling of pushing the instruments to their limits, you get an understanding of why changes were felt to have to be made to the instrument.
Exactly.
Don't you?
Exactly. When you play that repertoire on a Baroque instrument, you think, well, no wonder tort. Mm. And no wonder Spohr invented the chin rest. Like, he needed a little... The technology said he's pushing the music, so the technology needs to adapt.
Yes,
I mean, you know, it's exactly. both ways. Obviously, one influences the other, but just that feeling of like, well, the fingerboard doesn't go any further.
Yes, exactly.
So we're going to have to fight. We're going to have to make the fingerboard.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and spikes for cellists.
Exactly,
so the cellist
didn't work.
And it's quite interesting. Yes, so what you were saying just now about approaching different composers, it just happens this morning I was at a David Hockney exhibition. It was a wonderful, wonderful exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery. And here's David Hockney, very much himself, the most fabulous draftsman, but experimenting in the style of Picasso, in the style of Angres, in the style of all sorts of other, and yet still noticeably himself, but with all these different techniques he's using. And it was really fascinating. And I was just struck by the parallel with what you were just saying.
That is interesting. You know that I kind of have an aversion to neoclassical stuff.
Oh,
and I don't know.
Yes, I forgot that.
I don't want to bring up a touchy subject.
Is it a philosophical aversion, or you just don't like the sound?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's a philosophical aversion because I think it's right that they do that. You know, I think that's
it's like
we're talking about with Hockney. It's like it's a great process and step, and wonderful things can come out of it. But somehow, in music, I always feel that it's a bit, I don't know, like superficial, or it's like they're avoiding finding their own true voice. It's sidestepping what they're actually pushing for.
Are you saying that you feel that it's not art unless it's truly original?
Well, there's no such thing as truly original.
Well, there you are. You said it. But I mean, you don't see it as paying homage to the earlier composers and actually learning something from them by recreating through their own prism.
You could say that Brahms is doing that, you know.
Yes, or,
you
he know, certainly and,
you
was.
Know. But I think about all the things that Brahms burned, you know.
Oh, and, it's tragic, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I used to think it was tragic. I really used to think. I remember hearing about the 12 string quartets that he destroyed, and just crushing me when I first learned about that, thinking, well, you might not have thought they were good enough, but we'd love to hear them. We'd love to play them.
Sometimes it wasn't even him. Sometimes it was Clara Schumann.
Right,
wasn't
right, exactly.
That's even worse,
right, yeah.
Actually.
Well, I mean, he needed her. He needed her. The piano quintet is a good example of, like, it started off as a cello quintet, and she said, it's missing something. And then it became a two-piano thing. And then she said, what are you doing? Why are you missing out the strings? So he arrived at the final form thanks to her, which is, you know, ideal. But to go back to the string quartet thing, it's now I think, you know, he really knew what he was doing. And whatever exercises he had to work out, I respect him. He had to go through the writing of those in order to arrive at something that he was happy with. So I think that I don't want to deny them their right for a romantic composer to write a minuet, but I think good for them that they wrote it. And then the thing after that, that when they put it together with their own language and it's not so obviously homage, you know.
Well, okay,
you know what I mean?
Fair enough. I know what you mean, but going back again to what you were saying, I'm not talking about neoclassical now, but just thinking about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, the Mendelssohn Octet, we know the revised version, and there are available recorded versions of the unrevised version, his very first version when he was 16. And that is wonderful in its own way. And some of the things that got cut out in order to make the second version, it's a bit of a shame, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, I understand exactly why he did that, but I'm so glad we have the first version. Although he might be horrified, in the same way as Schumann might be horrified that we don't necessarily do his revised versions of his symphonies, that we often choose to do the first versions. And of course, once the composer's dead, they don't have any say in it.
You know that I like to argue whichever side of an argument suits me on
the day. I do know this, yes.
Depends on my mood.
I shouldn't
Depends
be winding
on
you up,
well,
should
you've
I?
You've invited me for a beautiful lunch, so I'm feeling quite relaxed.
Oh,
about it. But I think to argue the other side with Mendelssohn, it is funny. I think the final version of the octet is probably superior to that one. But the A major viola quintet, there's a revised version of that. Or is it the other one? One of the viola quintets has a revised version where he misses out this beautiful little viola tune. And you're going, what were you thinking? And then Symphony number 4, the Italian symphony, you know, the revised version is really not good. It's like he smooths out all the edges,
yes,
which is just such a shame.
It's not so fresh, is it?
And so you think maybe it's down to the character of the composer. You know, he was a perfectionist, and we just love Mendelssohn as a person, and you think you just should have left it alone.
But
you know?
It could have been outside influence, like Moscheles, the people he looked up to, and if they told him something.
Yeah, it's amazing to read some of his letters and see that he was insecure and sort of deferential to other people, and thinking, you're Mendelssohn, you don't you got, but you know, to bring in my other, one of my other childhood obsessions, Star Wars, it's you know,
yes,
very important.
Course.
We can't have a podcast without, yeah, is George Lucas and his tinkering with the Star Wars films, and sort of saying, oh, I didn't have the technology in the 70s to do what I wanted to do, and then he comes out with these other versions with these added bits,
yes,
that are just terrible.
Devalues it.
So I'm going, this man shepherded something that influenced my imagination for my entire life, became a lifelong obsession with those films, similar with Mendelssohn. And then I think, well, but they're also capable of getting it wrong. And it's the thing that you learn, that even great heroes and these great geniuses, they're capable of making mistakes.
Well, according to your opinion, he might still have been happy with it.
Well, he might have been. But I mean, I think the consensus on Mendelssohn Italian and George Lucas's re-edit of Star Wars, I think is that they both should have left well enough. Maybe it's easier for us to look at it from the outside and appreciate it. When they're in it, they're going, oh, I hated that bit and I really want to fix it. And they fix it and we all go, no, we love that bit, you know.
And whereas with the Baroque, thinking of Bach and Handel, who did reuse things, but very rarely left something exactly the same. Bach, even when he's taking a concerto from keyboard to string instrument or vice versa, he'll do a few odd different notes in their orchestral parts, but they're not worse, they're just interesting.
Do you think it's because they weren't working for posterity, that they just didn't care? They're like, I got to make music for this weekend. Whereas Mendelssohn, maybe you start to get into that, the weight of history, and thinking this is going to exist beyond me.
That's true.
I've got to get it right.
There was a lot more pressure by then, wasn't
you
there?
Know. Yeah.
And everything was for an audience, and the expectation was so high. Poor guy. I mean, having written that octet when he was 16 or whenever it was, and the Midsummer Night's Dream, where was there to go after that?
Right.
And there was an awful lot of that rather sort of saccharine stuff he wrote for Queen Victoria to sing, on the sort of parlour music.
I won't say any bad words about Mendelssohn, Nettie.
We do owe Mendelssohn a lot of thanks for reviving the St. Matthew Passion, don't we?
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. When you learn about those things and you go, oh, my favorite romantic composers were interested in the things that I was interested in. When you learn that Mendelssohn...
Star Wars.
Same thing. I don't know what George Lucas is into classical music-wise. But to know that Brahms was someone who looked back, and Mendelssohn was someone who looked back, and as a teenager playing the A minor quartet, which I'm contradicting myself again, is basically stolen from Beethoven.
Yes.
But that quartet as a teenager just was the most thrilling thing to play, to get addicted to string quartet playing. And then to learn later that, oh, he's the person who made Bach available to modern audiences. And you think, I connect with that. And that you see yourself in that kind of mentality. Not to compare myself to Mendelssohn.
Yikes. No, but I know what you mean. Yes, you know, but it is wonderful when you can find some sort of personal connection, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. And you talk about composers looking backwards, and then you get people like Berlioz looking forward and doing most extraordinary things. And C.P. Bach, for that matter. I often wonder what his father must have thought about some of his stuff. But maybe he really sort of got far more adventurous once his father had died. Maybe that's what it was.
Possibly, yeah.
I don't know. Mozart certainly took off once his father had died, didn't he? That he started branching out more. I know he's one of your very favourite
Absolutely my favourite composer. How can I put this? I think about him so much. You just find yourself beaming from ear to ear playing his music. All of a sudden, something happens, and I think in the viola part, where you just can't believe how good it is. And I'm going to quote my dearly departed friend Alan Weir, cellist from Tafel Music, who, when talking about Mozart, he said, "This music is so much better than it needs to be." You know, and there's that thing with Mozart where there's always that little bit of extra for you, because he was very aware of the audience that he was serving and the drama, whatever he needed to do to play in Paris or Prague or Vienna or whoever in Salzburg. But there's stuff that's there that feels like it's a message from him directly to the violists, you know?
Because he played viola.
He played viola. Yeah. But you're sitting there going, well, he didn't need to write that little line for us, but he did.
But he did.
You know, and it makes it so exciting. I have a quintet with friends called Spuni Kunife, which is
How do you pronounce that? I wouldn't be able to start.
Which is a made-up term by Mozart that we found in one of his letters.
What did he mean by that?
Well, that's the question.
Extra for the viola player.
It's probably something totally filthy. He asks his cousin, who he wrote all the dirty letters to, he asks her, do you still have the Spuni Kunife? Who knows? So we...
sounds very dodgy.
Anyway, we just like it because it rolls off the tongue once you start saying it. Spuni Kunife, Spuni Kunife, Spuni Kunife. But we play the six quintets for two violas. That's all we're playing right now. We think they're worlds unto themselves and deserve full attention the way a string quartet would give his quartets. And usually you play these pieces at a festival or a string quartet invites a friend to come play them with them. So we thought, let's be five equal people interpreting this music. And one of the things that's remarkable is the very last quintet that he wrote, the E-flat quintet, on the surface sounds really easy and simple and kind of a bit of a Haydn tribute. But once you start, when you slow it down and you see what's happening with every episode that arrives, the harmony is so complicated and so crazy and hilarious. And there's all this stuff going on that we have the feeling that we wish we could play it at half speed for the audience and spell it out so that they could hear what's going on. Because when it goes by so fast, you just hear this really nice... It's great. It's good times, you know. Yes. Like any audience, anybody would like it. But when you start looking into it, you go, oh my God, it's so much better than it needs to be. Mm. There's so much here. And why? Why did he take the time? Like, why did he suffer over that when he didn't have to? He could have whipped off something way easier, way faster, and maybe paid his bills, you know. But instead, he's you know, pouring over every bar. Every bar has something magical in it.
I think there'd be something to be said for you to playing it to the, say, we want to play this section to you slowly, just so that you can hear what's going on. I mean, that
really
might be quite a good selling point.
You do
need to do that. And of course, alongside all the stuff you're doing with them and OAE, there's your quartet based in New York.
That's right.
Which does a lot of contemporary music.
Only contemporary music.
Only contemporary music. Yep. Okay. And then, of course, something that also connects with OAE is that you're principal viola with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, and of which Maxim Emelianichev is principal conductor.
Yes. And, friend of the podcast, Maxim Emelianichev.
What?
Friend of the podcast. You know, he's...
Oh, yes, friend of the podcast. Yeah. I thought, this is a composer I haven't heard. Yes. Do you find that the way he behaves with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra is different to the way he behaves with OAE?
Mm.
Like, we did an amazing Saint-Saëns concert with him, didn't we, last January?
Yes. I think I've been told that I should stay professional, but I'm just going to throw tact out the window. Basically, in general, I don't like conductors. And I would say that most conductors are disappointing. Maybe that's a problem with my expectations of what they should deliver. And that might be because it's incredibly difficult. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. Who knows? No idea. Never tried it. But every once in a while, someone turns up who really delivers beyond your expectations. And Maxim is one of those people for me. And the first time I worked with him was Agrippina with the OAE at the Royal Opera House in 2019. And he had just come off Rinaldo with you guys at Glyndebourne.
Yes, okay.
And I remember you said to me, oh, I can't wait for you to meet this guy. I'm really curious what you think. And I remember we went into that first rehearsal and you were kind of eyeing me like, wait, let's see what my reaction was. And it's just, he's the real deal. Like,
yes.
I mean, it's immediate to me what you understand about Maxime is what he's got to me is the balance of the insistence on his vision and what he wants, and then also a strong belief that everyone should play free and feel comfortable. So he manages to balance that thing that, like, he knows what he wants and he'll go after it, But he looks at you and he wants everyone to be having a good time. Mm. He wants everyone to feel like they're in it. So it's the combination of those things, which I think is incredibly rare, because the people who really have strong vision can sometimes be overly controlling. And then you have directors who are like, oh, let's just all play together. And that can be fun, but it can lack that singular vision. Yeah. So he's got that balance, and he's so sensitive to his musicians that, as you say, he is different in front of different orchestras. And I think I'm very lucky to get to see him in different situations. And what's fun is my colleagues in SEO say, what's he like at OAE? You know, so he is different. That was a really memorable Saint-Saëns. Your brother played a great concerto.
And, the organ symphony.
Oh, and the organ symphony, yeah.
Who are the other grand exceptions to the Mandel negative view of conductors in general?
Okay, well,
just name me five.
Yes, five. I don't think I can get to five.
I'm sure you can.
Okay.
I might help
Well,
you.
The person who sort of helped me form a lot of my musical ideas is Bruno Weil, the German conductor who had a long relationship with Tafel music. And something Bruno talked about a lot is, which I think is why he's ideal for Beethoven, is that Beethoven is a conductor killer because they have to take themselves out of it. There's so much of Beethoven in Beethoven that there's not a lot of room for you, whoever you are. Like, it's get out of the way. And Bruno, to the point, his ego is based on trying to be a non-conductor. So he's egotistical about not having an ego. And so what you get with Bruno is the sense of the structure, and that if you don't mess around, and that's the historical performance practice, scrape off the shellac that's been put on these pieces and do what he says, and you're going to be fine. And to me, it was so inspiring to have someone who would insist, just don't indulge yourself. That rigor of rhythmic integrity and paying attention to the score and the text. And otherwise, he's a grumpy old German guy who only wants to talk about football and beer and Beethoven, basically. Those are his three subjects. So he was important to meet someone who had that kind of integrity, because so many of them are all about themselves, and Bruno just seemed to be entirely about the score. So that was important, because I'd met some that I didn't like. I really loved working with Simon Rattle and the OAE. I think Simon is someone who, I think that's the best rehearsal technique I've ever seen.
Yes.
I remember we did Bruckner 6 with him. That was my first time working with him. And we don't know Bruckner 6 in the OAE at all. And at the end of the first day, I thought, yeah, actually, we kind of know this piece now. We could go play it.
Yes.
And I just don't know what that is, like, because he knows when to tell a joke, he knows when to push, he does that thing where you feel he's connected to everyone, he's making eye contact with everyone. I mean, he is the master of getting a group on side.
And getting the best out of a whole group.
Exactly.
And all of us pulling in the same direction as well.
So to me, when I think about the art of running a rehearsal, I think Simon Rattle is really tops for me.
Yeah.
Who else are you thinking of?
Well, I think you like Suzuki, Masaaki Suzuki, don't you? Well, the Bach in particular with him. That made a big impression the first time you did that, didn't you?
Masaaki is it's that thing, because what you want from a conductor is someone who's going to insist, but make you feel empowered at the same time, not make you feel small.
Yeah.
So not scolding, but they have to demand the best. They have to push you, but they have to do it in a way that, like, feels okay for the orchestra, so that everyone feels it's their own. And Masaaki has this way of continuing to smile, and he's got that smile on his face, and he cheerfully will tell you that you sound terrible, that it's not very good, and he'll sort of laugh, and you go, yeah, you're right, that really wasn't very good that time. And then you go back at it and you think, he's with us. And it's a similar thing with Bruno. The integrity, I mean, Masaaki is...
And the amount of thought.
The amount of thought
and preparation
and
that's gone into it.
There's never any doubt. I did St. Matthew Passion with him in Tafel Music one time. You know, there's absolutely no question about... He's thought about every angle of that music. So you relax and you go, well, if there's an issue, he knows, he's seen it before. And so then you can play free. And he, again, he wants you to play free, I think. Within this frame of what he's after.
Yeah. And then... I have a feeling you had a really soft spot for Sir Roger Norrington before he retired.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah. Well, when I show up to work, this is the thing as saying it's always an audition. I mean, conductors, it's always a performance. They're performing for us, right? So, like, if I want to come to work and be entertained, right? Like, I want to have fun, and John Butt, another wonderful collaborator.
Yes,
it's John, a similar thing with John,
where it's
this sort of the jokes and are flying. I mean, Roger's a bit more hammy than John, but I loved working with him, and I think the times that I've worked with him, I'll never forget those times, because there weren't that many, just a handful of times that I worked with him. But yeah, just, it's fun. It's fun playing with Roger. It's like anything can happen. You got to be on the ball. It's like you can't even repeat the things he says in rehearsal. Yeah, I'm really going to miss him. And again, formatively, the recordings of Symphonies 2 and 8,
yes,
that to me
that
is the
one
best.
Of the best ever.
Best ever records, and 8 is the most underrated Beethoven symphony. I think it continues to blow my mind how great it is, and how difficult it is, actually. Mm. And the 5th symphony is remarkable, and I got to do 4 with him, which was really great, and 3.
Yeah,
such good times. Yeah, I'm really going to miss working with him.
Yeah, me too. Well, we're coming to the end of this, really. I think we've been going for quite a long time,
okay.
But the next thing that I'm going to be doing with you is working for Riccardo Minasi, and I'm very, very interested to see what you're going to make of him. Yes. Okay, well, thank you very, very much for sparing the time.
Anytime. And maybe as a way of wrapping up, let me just say that I think this podcast is fantastic. I listen to it all the time.
Oh, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.